Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Anne Rice, whose most recent novel is Prince Lestat. We'll also hear from Gary Crist, whose new book is Empire of Sin, a story of sex, jazz, murder, and the battle for modern New Orleans. Anne Rice is one of those guests who really doesn't need an introduction, especially here in New Orleans, where she is one of our most beloved authors. She's known for her vampire chronicles, her novels about Jesus Christ, the Chronicles of the Mayfair Witches, and the Wolfgift novels as well. She's coming to New Orleans for Halloween to celebrate the publication of Prince Lestat, the long-awaited return of one of her most beloved characters. Anne, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to be talking to you, Sue. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. Now, I remember so vividly your description of Lestat's departure. You said you were looking in a window of, I think, a car dealership on St. Charles Avenue, and you saw his reflection over your shoulder, and he vanished, and you knew he was gone, and that broke a lot of readers' hearts. So I wonder if you'd tell us about his return to you as a character. You obviously knew the time was right.
Well, I think I ended the Chronicles when I did because I really didn't have any new stories with him. I needed a rest, and he needed a rest. And the franchise, as they call it, the Vampire Chronicles, they needed a rest. As much as you love your readers and as much as you are grateful for their enthusiasm, you can't necessarily make a character come alive and talk and tell a story simply because you want that to happen. And what happened with me was that I needed some time off. Lestat had been my way of looking at the world for a long time and through a lot of different experiences, and some of those experiences were tragic and dark and involved loss. And I moved away from Lestat because I felt I had to do that. And frankly, I think it's worked out very well, because when I decided to go back to him, when I thought, well, okay, let me go back to the Chronicles and see if there's something there that I can revive. Well, when I finally decided that and I did go back, I was filled with ideas for new stories. And I could hear Lestat right away, and Lestat really did come back to me almost as if he walked in the front door and said, well, thank God you're listening to me again, Anne. You know, I have a whole lot to tell you. And it was really just wonderful. But I don't think that would have happened if I had struggled in the intervening time to keep writing about him when I didn't have anything to say.
Right. So here he's back in Lucky 13, the 13th novel in the series. Now, one of the most amazing things about this book, about Prince Lestat, is the way it sweeps through the entire universe you've created. It goes all the way back to the very beginning and projects forward to the future. What was it like for you to write such an encyclopedic novel? I mean, were you surrounded by your own books all the time?
I was. I had to reread almost all of them. And I have them all around me, and they're all marked up with notes and so forth. But this is the only way that I could get excited about doing it. I didn't want to turn out another autobiographical book in Lestat's voice or a memoir book about one of the vampires and what they've been doing. I had done those kinds of books. And I thought, if I'm going to go back to this, it's going to have to be about the whole tribe of the undead and what's going on with them. And I like that. I like working with a cosmology, creating a universe. It's not enough for me to just tell the old story again of somebody being made a vampire and coping with the shock of it all and becoming resigned to it or so forth and so on. I'd done that. So to me, this was the place to go, and this was the exciting place to go. I'd done it once before in Queen of the Damned, where I dealt with the whole tribe and what was going on with them and Lestat trying to come out to the world as a vampire. But I had dropped that afterwards, and the other Vampire Chronicles were different. And they were smaller in scope. They might have been longer in length, and they might have gone into a lot of serious questions and dramatic stories, but they didn't have that huge scope in terms of all the created characters. And I wanted to go back to that. And that's why at first I told people this is a sequel to Queen of the Damned, but that was misleading. It's really a sequel to all the books. It's the first one since Queen of the Damned that deals with the whole world of the undead.
Well, the great thing about it is that it's sort of like being at a vampire family reunion. You know, there are those characters you love, and then there are those older characters you sort of go, okay, I know what you're doing, and you know what I mean?
Have fun. I mean, that was a lot of fun because I get requests every day on Facebook, are you going to bring back Bianca? What happened to this person? Are you going to tell us what happened to that one? Where's Avicus? Where's Flavius? So I've been hearing that for years now, you know, incited my imagination quite a bit.
But the other great result of all this is that I think you could pick up this book, Princess Dot, and you could read it, even without having read the other books. Even if you only have the vaguest notion of what the Vampire Chronicles are about, I think it would make sense to a new reader, which is a kind of amazing thing to pull off, you know?
Well, I'm glad to hear that because I did intend to do that, because I think you have to do that with each book. I mean, you can't expect people to go read 12 other books to prepare for this. And so I tried to make it very much a stand on its own novel. And I always really try to do that with the vampire novels in particular, but I really felt I had to do it here. If I wanted them to enjoy it, they had to be able to enjoy it without doing homework.
Right. Although you do direct them to specific page numbers if they need to do homework, which I kind of loved.
The quotes at the beginning of the book?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I did include the quotes that I thought were really important for what the Chronicles were all about.
Now, what's clear in Prince Lestat is that vampires are under threat. They're under attack, the world around, at the behest of this mysterious voice.
Well, when it comes to the plot, again, I wanted to take the vampires right now in the world of 2013, 2014, and say, well, what are they doing? What is life like for them? Lestat, as we know, long ago, came out to the world as a vampire. He was a rock star. He had a big rock concert. He got vampires all over the planet very upset. They didn't want to be revealed to the public. They went after him. They tried to kill him. You know, things he did had other repercussions. And we got, in the earlier novels, a whole story of the origin of the vampires. And I wanted to ask, well, how's the whole tribe reacting to all that? What's happening to them, and what is life like for them in the world of satellite surveillance and TV and radio and internet radio and in the world of iPhones, in which they can communicate with each other by texting faster than they can send a telepathic message? What is it like, and what is their biggest threat? And I thought, well, the biggest threat to them, obviously, is that they're multiplying like never before. Because, number one, the world didn't catch on to the fact that they were there. They were dismissed as fiction. And they know that now, and they aren't really afraid of being found out by scientists or police. And they're multiplying everywhere because of transportation, and also they have a sense of who they are that they got from Lestat, from his telling the tales of who they were. So that's going to be the first biggest threat. They're multiplying, and they're getting into fights over territory all over the planet. And, of course, one of the things that they want is they want a leader, and nobody will step up and be a leader. And so I was off and running with that, and that's really what this book is about. Is somebody going to step up and be a leader? Why don't the very ancient ones do that? And what happens as people do struggle for power?
Now, one of the things that's so interesting is that even as science and technology offer threats to the vampires, they offer opportunities. And two of the really interesting characters in this book are scientists who want to explore vampires' nature.
That's true. Fareed Banzali, by the way, whom I named after my heart doctor in New Orleans, Dr. Banzali.
I had a feeling that might be it.
Yes, and hello, doctor, if you're out there.
Yes.
But anyway, Fareed is a scientist. And again, this struck me as a logical thing. Somebody, sooner or later, would have decided to bring over a scientist into the world of the undead to see what he could do for vampires. And that's developed throughout the book. And he's very much part of the plot, and he's a brilliant scientist. And his maker is an ancient vampire who was a healer in his time thousands of years ago.
But there's that fabulous knowledge of what a knife's edge it is to be explored, but to know, to be a subject of an experiment, and to need the knowledge that comes from that. And so much of this, of course, rallies around Lestat. He remains this charismatic figure, even when he drops out of sight for a while.
Yes, well, I think that's built into the Chronicles because he was the rock star. He did make all those rock videos that told everybody the history of vampires on the planet. And I figured he would have become a legend to the undead. He would have. He's the only one that has that kind of visibility to them.
Now, I know that it's been a long-held dream of yours to see more of your works on film, and you have some really good news for readers in that area, don't you?
Well, it looks good so far, yeah. Imagine Entertainment and Universal Studios have optioned the books, and I have great confidence in the producers. It's Brian Grazer and Erica Huggins of Imagine, and I think they will be faithful to the books. It looks better than ever for new Lestat movies. I'm filled with optimism. You never really know what's going to happen with Hollywood. You never really know. And this could all go wrong. Who knows? Or it could fall apart. You never know. I've been optimistic in the past and thought we were on our way to a series of movies, and it didn't happen. But I think right now things are better than ever.
And the Sleeping Beauty books are bound for the small screen.
Yes, yes. Rachel Winter, a brilliant producer, she produced the movie Dallas Buyers Club and so many Academy Awards. Rachel has bought the Sleeping Beauty books, and she wants to do a very high-quality cable TV show with them. And I'm co-producing with Rachel. I love Rachel. She's wonderful.
Well, that'll be fun to see those on TV. And you and your son Christopher have been touring together, which must have been a blast.
Yes, yes, it is. And we're continuing to tour. His new book, The Vines, is set in Louisiana. It's his second paranormal novel, his second supernatural book, and it's his second one back in New Orleans. And I think it's the best writing he's ever done, so it's a lot of fun to appear with Christopher. He picks up my spirits, and he loves doing stage events where we're both interviewed, and he makes it fun for me. He really does.
Oh, you make it fun for him, too. I know you do.
Well, you know, it's great to have your son be your writing buddy.
Yeah.
I love his writing, and yet his writing is very different from mine. And so we really are writing buddies. We can exchange manuscripts without the danger of influencing each other too much. And I think it's just great. It's wonderful.
Oh, you're just one of those writing families, you know? I think it's a splendid thing. So we've been talking with best-selling author Anne Rice, whose new book is Prince Lestat, due out October 28th. Tickets to the Vampire Lestat Fan Club Ball are all sold out, unfortunately, but you can meet Anne Rice, along with Christopher Rice, Sunday, November 2nd from 1 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event, so call the shop for more information. Anne, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Sue. It was a great pleasure to talk to you again. I really enjoyed it.
There's something shifting in the distance. Don't know what it is. Days as dead as night, except for that feeling that's growing up inside of me as you sing your song, as you swing along on your, it's your song.
Gary Crist is the author of three novels, two short story collections, and in his recent work has made a turn to nonfiction. He's the author of The White Cascade, about the Wellington train disaster, and City of Scoundrels. Today we'll be talking about his most recent book, Empire of Sin, a story of sex, jazz, murder, and the battle for modern New Orleans. Gary Crist, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, I love this subtitle. It's like the perfect search engine optimized list, you know, sex, jazz, murder, New Orleans.
I did try to pack it, everything in. My publisher actually said, can you fit Fast Cars and a Lost Mayan Treasure in there, too? But unfortunately, I couldn't get that in.
Maybe next time.
The book is titled to titillate, so to speak, but I like to think that there's a lot of good, serious history in it.
Yes, there absolutely is. Now, one of the things that interested me is that you've described the moment you knew you had a story about the White Cascade, for example. You were reading one person's words, and you knew you had to follow that story wherever it led you. How did you know you had a story about New Orleans? What was that moment for you with this book?
Well, I've always been interested in how good intentions sometimes backfire. And what is most interesting, I think, about what's going on in the Storyville era in New Orleans, what people sometimes don't realize is the creation of Storyville was a reformist move. It wasn't some machine politician saying, let's create a legalized red light district. It was the reformers who did it because they thought, well, obviously, we're not going to be able to stamp out prostitution in New Orleans entirely. So instead, why don't we be practical? Why don't we set up this area, which is somewhat remote from the central, more respectable parts of town, and move all vice and prostitution into that area so that, you know, so-called respectable people wouldn't have to come into contact with it. And of course, for a while, it did seem to work. The district was created in 1898. In the first few years, you know, the city seemed a little cleaned up. But then Storyville just took off. It became wildly successful. And so far from lowering the profile of prostitution in New Orleans, it soon made New Orleans famous worldwide as this supermarket of sin. So I'm always fascinated when best intentions sometimes have the exact opposite results that were intended.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out that Storyville was really a reformist move, that said, oh, I've got to follow that.
Now, you date the beginning of what you call New Orleans Civil War to October 16, 1890, the death of Police Chief David Hennessy. Tell us about that death and your terms for the Civil War that followed.
One of the problems that New Orleans was facing in the late 19th century was a serious crime problem, and a lot of it was attributed, not always entirely fairly, to what they regarded as a mafia. There was a huge population of Sicilians in the lower part of the French Quarter, and the police said this is mafia. Whether it was really mafia is not quite clear, but there was certainly a lot of crime going on down there, and as long as it was Italian-on-Italian crime, it seemed that the good people of the better half, quote-unquote, of New Orleans wasn't that concerned. But then when the police chief, David Hennessy, who was the youngest police chief in the country, started an investigation into the crime of what was sometimes called Little Palermo, then things got serious, and one night he was walking home from his job, and six or seven men stepped out with sawed-off shotguns and basically shot him dead on the street. And this created a wild reaction among the better half of New Orleans, and they said, we have to get this Italian crime situation under control. And eventually what happened, there were court cases and things like that. The alleged assassins were acquitted, which enraged people even more, and ultimately the parish prison was stormed and 11 Italians, some of whom had not even been put on trial yet, were killed by a mob. So this was the sort of dramatic first part of the war. This is what more or less set it off. And it was not only a war against crime, it was a war against African-American jazz culture, it was a war against the Italian underworld, and it was a war against vice and prostitution. They really felt that they were losing control of the city to its less reputable element.
Now, you also take on one of the most infamous murder cases in New Orleans history, the case of the murdering Axeman.
That was definitely a sexy topic, I have to say. The Axeman has never been definitely identified. As a matter of fact, there is even some doubt as to how many of the so-called Axeman crimes were actually committed by one person. But this was a series of horrible axe murders that cropped up in late 1918 and through 1919. And for a year and a half, the city was in absolute terror of the Axeman. The police seemed helpless to do anything about it. And he just kept on appearing, and people would have their doors chiseled, and the Axeman would come in and murder them in their sleep. My favorite episode of the Axeman story is when someone purporting to be the Axeman wrote an open letter to the Times-Picayune newspaper saying that he was going to strike again on St. Joseph's evening, you know, in March, but that he was fond of jazz music, so he would spare any household in which jazz was being played. So you can imagine that the city of New Orleans took this as a good excuse for having a great party on St. Joseph's evening. And as it turned out, the Axeman did not show up, so presumably there was enough jazz playing in the city to his taste.
Typical. That's all I can say. Now, in these two recent books of yours, you seem to be refining your focus a bit toward cities in crisis. There are so many people I know who adore books about cities and even collect biographies of cities. And now, is that something you still feel drawn to?
Yeah, I think cities are wonderful. I think that the proximity you have in a city of people of different races, people of different social classes, people of different ethnicities and backgrounds really produces some interesting effects. You know, often it's creative and innovative, and, you know, this is why cities are the source of innovation, I think, in our society. But it also creates a lot of friction as, you know, competing groups want to declare their rights and the group next to them does not want to give them their rights. So I end up writing a lot about riots and urban strife, but I do think that such things are sometimes more like growing pains than anything. Mm-hmm. And it really is such a fecund atmosphere when you have all of these different groups cheek by jowl in a major city. And I think that's where so much of the innovation in our society comes from.
And so much energy for your stories comes from the variety of characters. I mean, this book is populated with such amazing and well-known-to-us characters, of course. Josie Arlington, Tom Anderson, Louis Armstrong, Buddy Bolden, Kid Ory, and, you know, even the infamous murdering Axeman. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about those characters and how they drew you. The story of Josie Arlington, I thought in particular, was interesting.
Well, I think that she's particularly interesting because she's an example of, I think, one of the good things that came out of Storyville. You know, in late 19th, early 20th century New Orleans, there really weren't that many avenues for working class women to have any kind of success, any kind of financial success. And here, Josie Arlington started out as an orphan. She was selling apples on the street. She was actually forced into prostitution as a very young girl. But by the early teens, as a brothel owner, she owned one of the most glamorous brothels on Basin Street. She had earned enough money to set herself up in an upper middle class lifestyle. She bought a big white mansion up on Esplanade, and she moved her entire family in there, and she was able to achieve a kind of upper middle class success through prostitution, through the tolerant atmosphere of Storyville. And as bad as the situation was for working-class white women, working-class African-American women had it even harder, and yet there were some African-American brothel owners who achieved a real financial success. Lulu White is probably the most famous. It was also Countess, quote-unquote Countess,
yes.
Willie Piazza, mm-hmm. who owned a brothel on Basin Street. And after Storyville closed, Willie Piazza, at least, went into real estate. And when she died, she left a whole portfolio of real estate. She had turned herself into an economic success. Lulu White's story is not quite that good. So it's interesting to me that Storyville, you know, this sinful place, really was an avenue to success for a lot of people who didn't have many alternatives in early 20th century New Orleans otherwise.
And Tom Anderson was another one who sought mainstream respectability as well.
Right. Yeah, yeah. He was a short, scrappy kid from the Irish Channel neighborhood, and he rose to become the most powerful vice lord in the city. And he was also a politician. He represented the 4th Ward for 20 years in the legislature. He was very successful as an oil man. But he also had a whole range of brothels and cabarets and restaurants on the other side of the law. So he was able to make a success of himself on both sides of the law. And they called him the mayor of Storyville.
Right.
He was so powerful in that particular part of the city.
Well, it is such a pleasure to read this book. It is endlessly fascinating. We've been talking with Gary Crist about his new book, Empire of Sin, a story of sex, jazz, murder, and the battle for modern New Orleans. You can meet him Saturday, November 1st at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge. Thank you so much, Gary.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Here's Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Annie Bloch Raymond signs From the Banks of the Rhine to the Banks of the Mississippi, the history of Jewish immigrants and their individual stories. And Carol Mills Nichols signs Louisiana's Jewish immigrants from Basrein, Alsace, France, Tuesday, October 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kevin Fortuna signs The Dunning Man, Tuesday, October 28th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Cecilia Casserole D'Artes, author of Jenny Giraffe, Discovers Papa Noel, Ryan Adam, author of New Orleans Mother Goose, and Johnette Downing, author of Macarooned on a Desert Island, discuss their work Tuesday, October 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Ann Byrne signs Ann Byrne Saves the Day Cookbook, Wednesday, October 29th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Saturday, November 1st from 9 to 10:30 at the Crescent City Farmers Market. Room 220 presents Eli Horowitz reading from The Silent History, Wednesday, October 29th at 7 at Press Street Headquarters, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Mamie Gasparez discusses Luxury, Inequity, and Yellow Fever, Living Legacies and the Story of Old New Orleans, Wednesday, October 30th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Candace Huber's Tubby and Coos Mid-City Bookshop at 631 North Carrollton will celebrate its grand opening weekend coming up with a Halloween party Friday, October 31st from 5:30 to 8. Events include a pet, child, and adult costume contest, Halloween games, and spooky story time. The rest of the weekend will feature book signings by more than 25 local authors, appearances from fan groups, and children's story time. Not only that, but a chance to meet Tubby himself, Huber's grandfather, who turns 94 on November 2nd. More information and a complete schedule can be found on Tubby and Coos' Facebook page. Kit Wall signs New Orleans Classic Creole Recipes Saturday, November 1st from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Lee Bardugo signs Ruin and Rising Saturday, November 1st at 5 at Octavia Books. Anne Rice signs Prince Lestat, along with her son Christopher Rice signing his new book, The Vines, Sunday, November 2nd from 1 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Edward E. Baptist signs The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, Sunday, November 2nd at 2 p.m. at Octavia Books. Carrie Lynn signs Madam, A Novel of New Orleans, Sunday, November 2nd at 4 at Octavia Books. Natalie Parker, author of Beware the Wild, Tessa Grattan, author of The Blood Journals, and Julie Murphy, author of Side Effects May Vary, sign their young adult books Monday, November 3rd at 5:30 at Octavia Books. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Laurie King's Touchstone, Tuesday, November 4th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Gary Crist signs Empire of Sin, A Story of Sex, Jazz, Murder, and the Battle for Modern New Orleans, Tuesday, November 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. He also appears Saturday, November 1st at the Louisiana Book Festival from 12:15 to 12:45 in Senate Committee Room A. Catherine Lacey, author of the debut novel Nobody Is Ever Missing, is the featured reader at the 1718 Reading Series, Tuesday, November 4th at 7 at the Collins Hotel. The big event this week is the Louisiana Book Festival, Saturday, November 1st at the State Capitol Grounds in Baton Rouge, featuring such well-known writers as Rick Bragg, whose new book is Jerry Lee Lewis, His Own Story, Charles Blow, whose stunning new memoir is Fire Shut Up in My Bones, former Louisiana Writer Award winner Ernest Gaines, State Poet Laureate Ava LaVelle Hayman, best-selling author Cokie Roberts, and this year's Louisiana Writer Award winner and former State Poet Laureate Daryl Bork. There will be a children's book tent, cooking demos, exhibits at the State Museum and the State Library. A host of New Orleans writers will be in attendance. Anne Benoit, Brian Boyles, Moira Crone, Gina Ferrara, Oliver Houck, Laura Kelly, Laura Lane McNeil, Michael Petrie, Michael Ross, Mona Lisa Saloy, Ben Sandmill, Richard Sexton, and Chris Wiltz, to name only a few. It's a wonderful event, and it's all free. For a complete schedule, go to louisianabookfestival.org, and I'll see you there. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.